I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Luis von Ahn, an inventor and computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon. Luis is one of the creators of CAPTCHA, a device that allows websites to determine whether you're a human or a computer trying to abuse your system. CAPTCHAs are wavy, distorted words on screens that people need to type out when you're submitting a form to a website to confirm that you're not a bot. His company, ReCAPTCHA, proved users were humans while digitizing books. The company was sold to Google in 2009. In 2011, Luis founded Duolingo, the most popular language learning program on the web, attracting over 150 million users in its first 4 years. Users worldwide learn a language for free while also translating the web into every major language. Investors include Google, NEA, Kleiner Perkins, Ashton Kutcher, and Tim Ferriss. Luis graduated from Duke in 2000 and got a PhD from Carnegie Mellon in 2005. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2006 and is from Guatemala. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And all this, by the way, since 1978, the year you were born.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about CAPTCHA first and about your research, because your research at Duke and Carnegie Mellon has informed your career and your companies. Can you tell us what it means again?
Yeah, so CAPTCHA is those distorted squiggly characters that you have to type all over the internet whenever you're buying tickets on Ticketmaster. Whenever you're getting a new account, for example, an email account from Gmail, or whenever you're opening an account on Facebook, you usually have to type these distorted characters. And CAPTCHA stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. Basically, what it is it's a test to determine whether you're actually a human. So, for example, in the case of Ticketmaster, those CAPTCHAs are there, the distorted characters are there to make sure that somebody didn't write a program to buy kind of all the tickets for a concert, kind of two at a time.
You developed the term CAPTCHA with a professor of yours, Manuel Blum, who was a professor at Carnegie Mellon. How did you come on to this concept of security versus any other form?
In about the year 2000, I was listening to a talk at Carnegie Mellon from a guy named Uri Manber, who at the time was the chief scientist of Yahoo. He had a talk about 10 problems that they couldn't solve at Yahoo. One of them was they had a problem with people who were writing programs to obtain millions of email accounts from Yahoo. The people who were doing this were spammers, and so they were basically supporting spammers, and they didn't want to do that. Over the next few months, with my PhD advisor, Manuel, we came up with this idea of coming up with a test. You know, at the time, nobody had thought, well, we should test whether they're a human or not. How do we stop these people from getting free email accounts? And we came up with the idea that, well, one way to stop them is to make sure that it's a human actually getting them, because humans can't get millions of accounts. Humans can only get a couple hundred accounts, because afterwards they get bored. So that was the idea.
I've always liked the name CAPTCHA because it's sort of like gotcha, you know?
Yeah,
lucky
that
you.
That was the idea. It's like, yeah, capture or gotcha or something.
Isn't it interesting path dependency? Like, you happen to be sitting at this lecture with this Yahoo guy, and had you not encountered him or had your relationship with Manuel, this might never have been. And it's always hard to think of counterfactuals, and you might have gone on to create something else that's innovative. But funny how things happen through happenstance like this.
Yeah, there were all kinds of things. I mean, I was torn about whether I should go get my PhD at Carnegie Mellon or whether I should go. I was considering at the time going to Berkeley or Stanford, and it wasn't clear. So yeah, there were all kinds of happenstance there.
Why did you choose Carnegie Mellon over Stanford or Berkeley?
Because I wanted to work with my advisor, Manuel. I mean, he was this guy won a Turing Award, which is kind of the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Computer Science. And he was, we hit it off really well as soon as I met him. So I chose Carnegie Mellon over all these schools because I could work with him.
And by the way, we mentioned Turing. You tell me exactly.
Yeah, Alan Turing is widely considered the guy who, the father of computer science. There's a movie about him, The Imitation Game. I mean, he was he was a mathematician in the middle of the century, a British mathematician in the 1940s, 1950s. The British government contracted him to break the Enigma machine. But among other things that he did, he essentially started the field of computer science, and he had all kinds of ideas. And one of his ideas was, he thought, well, at some point, computers are going to be probably about as human, as intelligent as humans. And one of the questions that he addressed was, when will we know that a computer is as intelligent as a human? And he came up with this idea of what's called the Turing test. Imagine there's a human judge that is talking over texting with a human and a computer. And if the human judge cannot tell which one's which, then we will say that that computer has passed the Turing test. Everybody in the field of computer science knows about the Turing test. And this is very similar to a Turing test, where you're trying to distinguish if you're talking to a human or a computer. But the big difference is the judge, in this case, had to be a computer, not a human. So it had to be. So it's this paradoxical thing that a computer needs to be able to determine whether it's talking to a human or a computer, but a computer should not be able to pass this test.
Now, in the same research as you were trying to develop this idea of CAPTCHA, you also came up with the idea of GWAPs, which are games with a purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, can you describe that, and how are they related?
Yeah, so I helped develop this notion of a CAPTCHA, and then it started being used by all kinds of websites. Pretty quickly, Yahoo started using it. They had an actual big
need.
Problem. Yeah, so pretty quickly they started using it, and all kinds of websites started using it. And then that became my research, where coming up with things that computers could not do, but humans could do. In particular, I had just gone to a talk about somebody who was at the time working on a computer program to try to solve crossword puzzles. I thought, okay, computers can't do that. Then I got on a plane, and I noticed that everybody in my row was trying to solve a crossword puzzle. And I thought, whoa, these people are doing something that computers cannot do, and they're doing it willingly. So can we get people to do the things that computers can't willingly? And that's where the idea of games with a purpose came, where the idea is these are games that people are playing, like crossword puzzles, but as they're playing them, they're trying to solve a problem that computers cannot solve. Yeah. And, you know, this was before the word crowdsourcing even existed, et cetera, but this is like the first instantiation of or idea of kind of crowdsourcing. Instead of getting computers to solve problems, can we get humans over the internet to just solve them for us?
Now, this is all around 2005, 2006. In 2006, you get the MacArthur Genius Award. How does that happen? Was that out of the blue, or did you know you were nominated? What is that process?
No, I had no idea I was nominated. I suppose somebody nominates you, but you're never aware of it. And in the meantime, the MacArthur Foundation is doing a whole lot of research on you and what, you know, whether you should get one of these or not. And at some point, you just get a phone call saying, hey, you just got the MacArthur Award. But they're a little sneaky. Before that, they do contact you in ways that you don't realize. I mean, for example, in my case, there was somebody who was supposed to be a PhD student in psychology who was very interested in my research. And actually that was them. And one of the things they needed to make sure of is that when I got the phone call, I was there in my office. And this person said, "Oh, I'm gonna come on that day." And so I was in my office waiting for this person, and I just got a phone call.
Wow.
So they're a bit sneaky like that.
Who nominated you ultimately? Do you know?
You never find out.
You were less than 30 years old. You were, what, 28 years old when you won the award?
Give or take, yeah.
So in this, you know, five-year period, you get the MacArthur Genius Award, you develop CAPTCHA, you're working with companies like Yahoo. How did you go about commercializing CAPTCHA with Yahoo, for example?
So the first instantiation of that was not commercialized at all. We just gave it to Yahoo for free. We were super happy for them to use it. We were academics, and we were just happy that somebody was using what we were doing. Later, I did start a company related to CAPTCHAs, but it was that was in 2006 where I started this other company called ReCAPTCHA, and that became a commercial venture, but that was much later.
And prior to ReCAPTCHA, your first company was called ESP,
yeah,
which was matching images where two users in two different geographic locations are using their computers to identify images, mm-hmm, and they're playing a game. They have to match their description of the image. The founders of Google, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, got wind of this. You gave a speech at Google where they met you, where the founders met you. Can
I
you
did.
Describe that?
Yeah, so that's what happened. I mean, I mean, a few people from Google heard about my work, and so I went to Google. This is 2003, 2004. It's a much smaller company. So I gave a speech, and the two founders were actually in the audience. And then right after, they just, very simply just said, hey, We're going to make use of this. So can we buy it?
Mm-hmm. And it became part of their image labeler.
Yes, it became their Google image labeler, which was the thing that was used to improve search engine.
ESP was a one-man band that you sold to Google. And then your next company was ReCAPTCHA that you started in 2006, which basically was proving that you were human again, but while digitizing books. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that idea?
So this was similar to the idea of the ESP game or the Google Image Labeler, where, I mean, we're trying to get people to solve problems for us that computers cannot. And in this case, the idea was the following. By 2006, CAPTCHAs were used all over the internet. Every single kind of major website used CAPTCHAs. I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation about how many CAPTCHAs were typed by people around the world, and the number that I came up with was about 200 million times a day. So 200 million times a day, somebody was typing a CAPTCHA. First, I was very proud of myself. I thought, look at the impact that I've had. But then I started feeling bad because not only everybody kind of hated those things. I mean, the CAPTCHAs are kind of universally hated. But also, each time you type one of these, you waste about 10 seconds of your time. And if you multiply 10 seconds by 200 million, you get that humanity was wasting about 500,000 hours every day typing these. So I started thinking, okay, can we get them to solve an important problem, because during those 10 seconds, they're doing something that by definition computers cannot do. So can we get them to do something useful? And I came up with the idea of helping to digitize books. The idea is you want to put the book on the internet. The first step is you scan every page of the book. Now, scanning, literally what it is taking a digital photograph of every page. The next step in the process is that the computer needs to look at these pictures of pages and extract all the words, so decipher all of the words in there. The problem is that for older books, the computer could not recognize many of the words. For the same reason the computers cannot read these distorted the CAPTCHAs, for older books, sometimes the ink is a little faded and the pages have turned yellow or the picture may be a little blurry and it just cannot read. And at the time, about 30% of the words could not be read by the computer. So I thought, well, if I look at one of these pictures and I can read 100% of the words. So can we get people to do it? So that was the idea. The idea was to take all of the words that the computer could not recognize in a book digitization process and then extract them as a picture and then send them over the internet to somebody who's typing a CAPTCHA. And whenever they type it, we're going to use what they typed to help digitize the book. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea of this company, and that started in 2006.
So incorporating the games with a purpose into this, incorporating crowdsourcing into this, all kind of, you know, gelling into this one stew of a company, mm-hmm. ReCAPTCHA. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Luis Von Ahn, an inventor and computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon. We'll hear more from Luis coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Luis Von Ahn, an inventor and computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon. Luis is one of the inventors of CAPTCHA, a device that allows websites to determine whether you're a human or a computer using those wavy, distorted words on screens. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2006 and is from Guatemala. When you started the company, ReCAPTCHA, how did you monetize? How did you make money from this endeavor with digitizing the books?
So the idea is we provided a free CAPTCHA service to websites, but the way we would make money is we would charge for book digitization. For example, we started helping to digitize all the New York Times archives, but they had scanned them and they had this huge problem that, yeah, it was scanned, but computers couldn't recognize about 30% of the words.
Did you have venture capital?
No. Yeah. We didn't need it. I mean, on the day we started the company, we were making yeah, a few million dollars a year already, and we didn't need to spend that much.
Google acquired ReCAPTCHA in 2009.
Yeah.
You in 2011 started Duolingo, which is the most popular language app on the web. And basically, you want to provide free language learning to anyone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that idea?
Well, it started, in 2009, Google bought ReCAPTCHA. And I went to Google for a little while after they acquired it. And I started really thinking, well, what do I want to do after this? And it was an interesting time because I had more than enough solved my financial problems forever, and for me and for my kids. And it was fine. So I kind of didn't have to worry about money anymore. Mm-hmm.
Do we know what, how much they bought it for, or is that private?
It's private.
Okay.
Yep. But I was, I was in a situation where I was a very fortunate situation. But I started thinking, okay, what is it that I want to do for the next, you know, say 10 years? Ever since age 10, I wanted to be a professor. So education was always my passion. My views on education were always related to the fact that I'm from Guatemala. It's a very poor country. And a lot of people talk about education as something that brings equality to different social classes. But what I saw in Guatemala and what you see in most developing countries is that it's the opposite. Usually, people who have a lot of money can buy themselves the best education in the world. And because they're so well educated, they keep on having a lot of money. Whereas people who don't have very much money, in especially in developing countries, barely learn how to read and write. So I wanted to do something related to education, but that would give equal access to everybody. So I decided that to work on one aspect of education, which is very large, happens to be very large in most every country except the U.S., which is learning a foreign language. There's 1.2 billion people in the world learning a foreign language. The majority of these people, 800 million of them, satisfy three properties. First, they're learning English. Second, the reason they're learning English is to get a job. And third, they are of low socioeconomic conditions. Okay, so most people learning a foreign language are basically trying to learn English in order to get out of poverty. That's it. Mm-hmm. But the ironic thing is, at the time, most of the ways there were to learn a foreign language were really expensive, particularly through software. So at the time, it was a kind of the height of Rosetta Stone. It was about between $500 and $1,000.
So if you're poor, it's hard to get the $1,000 to pay.
Yeah, this is
to
the
learn
ironic
English.
Part, right? I mean, you're trying to get learn English to get out of poverty, but it seems you need $1,000, which makes no sense. So we decided to launch something to teach languages. But the whole goal was, no matter what, this is always going to be free. Now, the question is, how are we going to keep it free? And at the time, I thought, you know, this is one of those, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I thought, let's do the same thing we did with reCAPTCHA. Where with reCAPTCHA, what we were doing is we were providing this free CAPTCHA service, but in the background, we were making money from people, helping us digitize books. So can we do the same thing with languages? Can we provide a free language learning website, but in the background, we would be making money with people doing something useful for us? I started this with my PhD student at the time, a guy named Severin Hacker, which is funny. His last name is Hacker. We thought, okay, the thing that people can do while they're learning a language is to help us translate stuff. Can we, as people are learning a language, get them to translate useful stuff? And that was the idea with Duolingo, and it worked.
So again, you used the CAPTCHA idea and the GWAP, the games with a purpose and crowdsourcing idea, to come up with a monetization tool for Duolingo.
Uh-huh.
Having companies pay you to translate content on their websites.
That's exactly right. And so pretty soon after we launched, CNN became our client. So what they were doing is they would write all their news in English, CNN, and they would send us the news in English. And then what we did is we had this language learning website, Duolingo, which we had just launched. And we would give this news to some of our users. And then it was users that were learning English. So, for example, Spanish-speaking users learning English, they would get it, and they would help translate the news into their native language, into Spanish. And they were doing it, of course, to help learn English. And then we would send that news story back to CNN, but translate it. We've actually moved away from this. This is not what we're doing anymore, but this was what we launched Duolingo with.
What are you doing since then?
We realized that over time, we were spending more and more time on the translation quality than on actually teaching, because that's where the money was coming from. At some point, Severin and I were having dinner one time, and we thought, well, we've turned into a translations company. And do we really want to be a translations company? And first of all, this was not what we set out to do. We didn't want to be a translations company. And secondly, the translations business is not a good business to be in. It's a race to the bottom. This was a tough decision because it was a business model that seemed to be working, but we decided we're going to stop this. And so we actually cut the contract with CNN and with BuzzFeed, and we moved away from that.
You did that because you wanted primarily to be a language learning company, not
right.
a translation company, which basically becomes a commodity. And it's those decisions are the hardest when things are still going well.
Yeah.
Did you have any pressure from your venture capital partners to do that?
Yes and no. I wouldn't say strong pressure. I mean, the language learning market is a much larger market
right.
than the translations market, and a growing one, as opposed to you have this other problem.
Translation,
you also have this other problem that there's this looming thing that at some point Google Translate is going to get really amazing.
Yeah. You had a pivot moment at this dinner with Mr. Hacker, with Severin. What have you decided to become?
we decided to become a language learning company. We thought, oh, how are we going to make money?
Right.
Particularly given the fact that one of our tenets is we can't charge. We have three business models. And, you know, this is one of those things. When somebody says they have three business models, that means they don't have a business model. But we have three that are, each of them is working okay. So the first one, and the one that we've been spending most of our time on, actually a couple of them came from our own users. We started getting a very common email, very similar email from a lot of our users, and it was the following. It would say, thank you so much for teaching me English. I was not able to afford learning English before this, but now I have a problem, and it is that I need a certificate that shows that I know English. People were asking, you know, can you give me a certificate? We started looking into this whole certification business, and what we found was pretty insane. So first of all, $10 billion a year are spent by people certifying that they know English. That's a huge amount. And there's all kinds of reasons. People who apply to come to college in the US, the way they certify it is they have to take a standardized test called the TOEFL. But there's other reasons. If you want to get a work visa in the UK or Canada or Australia, anywhere in the Commonwealth, you have to take a standardized test that proves that you know English. If you work for many multinational corporations in non-English speaking countries, you have to take a standardized test. So it costs about $250. You usually have to take them in a physical testing center. You have to make an appointment a few weeks in advance, about 4 weeks in advance. Then you take the test. Then you have to wait about another 4 weeks for your results. So the whole process takes about 8 weeks, costs about $250, and you have to go somewhere. That sounded pretty annoying to us, but then it's even worse because most people who are doing this are in developing countries. It's way worse. $250, that's a month's salary.
So what is your solution?
We came up with a test that you can take from an app. You don't have to go to a physical testing center. And also, our test is way cheaper. As opposed to $250, we charge $50.
You've raised venture capital for Duolingo. It's the first time you have done so. Do you have any interesting stories on that process?
The first time around, it was not as difficult as in the first round of funding. The first and second round of fundings, we raised them essentially on the fact that I had done something before.
Right.
I mean, we had an idea, right. Whatever.
And that was Google and Union Square.
Union Square Ventures was the first one,
okay.
And we loved working with them. I mean, they're here in New York. One of the interesting things, so we're not in Silicon Valley. So Duolingo is actually located in Pittsburgh because of Carnegie Mellon University. One of the interesting things is when we raised funds, we found that the Silicon Valley investors all wanted to invest, but they all in their term sheets it said, "You got to move to Silicon Valley." They all said that. Whereas we found that the New York investors didn't say that. They said, "Oh yeah, we'll travel to you." So we went with a New York investor at the first round. After a while, after Duolingo had been going, you know, you can get money probably one or two rounds based on your previous stuff. But once you've gotten a couple of rounds, you have to get money based on your success. So in the, you know, when we got, for example, when we raised money from Kleiner Perkins, that was based on Duolingo's success and traction. And you know, at that time, we started being able to get money from West Coast investors without making us move because they're like,
yeah.
All right, fine. You seem to be doing okay in Pittsburgh.
You're from Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother and father are doctors.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of doctors are they?
So my mother's a pediatrician. My father is they do basically bone type stuff.
Your last name is Von Ahn. You're originally German.
Uh-huh.
When did your family come from Germany?
My father's parents came in the early 20th century.
And what was the impetus for their coming?
There was quite a number of people from Germany and from Europe coming to Latin America because of essentially for business opportunity. I mean, in Guatemala in particular, what was going on is the educational levels were pretty low. Whereas if you came with a German education, you probably could do pretty well. So, you know, they started a farm and they knew about technology enough to essentially succeed with little to no competition.
In addition to your parents being practicing doctors, they owned a candy factory. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so my mom is my mom's side of the family. So my grandparents from my mother's side of the family decided to start a candy factory. They were both from Spain. It happened to grow quite a bit. My grandfather died at an early age, so it was then my grandmother who ran this candy factory, and it became the most popular candy factory in Guatemala. They made like marshmallows and you know, chocolate and all kinds of candies. At some point, they had, by the way, 12 children.
Yeah.
And my mother was one of them. And at some point, they passed on the baton to their children, and so my mother was one of the basically 12 owners of this. And that was me growing up. I essentially didn't like the candy.
How come?
Well, I got bored of it after a while. I mean, I ate so much that I got bored of it, but I loved the machines. So on Sundays, I would go in there and essentially break machines. I was not loved by the engineers.
You'd break them because you wanted to see what they were like inside, or you accidentally broke them?
No. I took them apart, and yeah. I would do stuff about taking them apart. Of course, I would take them apart, and then when I try to put them back together, I would be left with two or three pieces that I didn't know where they went, and that was the problem.
What was the name of the candy company?
It was called Tropical Candy. It's still there.
Yeah. So marshmallow, chocolate, what else?
Gummy bears, and, you know, almost any type of candy.
From an early age, you seem to have this curiosity about how machines worked, yet your focus is on computer science. Did you think you might want to be more of a physical, like, engineer, mechanically?
Early on, I wanted to be. I mean, I really wanted to understand how all the machines worked, and I sat there at home making little, you know, gizmos that probably didn't do much, but I was very excited by that. It all changed when I was 8. I wanted a Nintendo. And my mother bought me a computer instead of a Nintendo. I was pretty pissed off because all my friends had a Nintendo, and she didn't get me a Nintendo. This was, you know, in the 80s. Computers were not super easy to use. And she also didn't happen to buy me a super easy to use computer. And so, well, what I wanted to do was play games. So what I did is I had to figure out how to use the computer to play games. I started essentially pirating games from other people, so I became quite a game pirate in Guatemala. that's how I got good with computers.
Yeah, so this is at the age of, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11.
Yeah, the pirating of games was more like 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, at the age of 12 also, you had this idea to make gyms free or start this business for free gyms. Tell me about that.
Well, at the time, I thought I was the first person to ever come up with this idea. I was not. A lot of people have come up with this idea.
Let me guess. Harnessing the electricity that you produce by exercising.
Yes. Thousands, if not millions of people have had this idea, right? It is. But at the time, you know, this is like a 10-year-old kid. I was like, I have this amazing idea. I will become a gazillionaire from this idea. I also thought it really worked. You know, this is by age 13 or 14. I thought the way we're going to make money is by selling the electricity to the electric company. Unfortunately, you know, when I got older, you start being able to calculate how much electricity you can sell. It turns out it's not a lot.
Right.
And then you start also realizing about the gyms that most of the money that gyms make are actually by people who sign up but never show up.
Yeah.
And so this is not a good idea.
So you seem to be kind of a self-starting, industrious little kid. Did you have that view of yourself? And was that kind of the perception among your family members? Or how would they describe you?
Yeah, they would describe me probably as nerdy and with a little too much energy. Mm. That's probably, I mean, I was always doing, basically getting in trouble, not getting in trouble because, you know, I was going out too late or anything, but getting in trouble by breaking things. I mean, one time I wanted to make a helicopter with an electric motor. I thought the way to make it a helicopter is basically by having a fan pointing it down, and if it spins fast enough, it's a helicopter. Turns out that is not the same kind of blade. And so I bought this huge battery for it, and it wasn't doing it. Then at some point I realized that if I connected it to the electricity, this would help make it go faster. So I connected it to electricity, and then I made, you know, not only my house, but a couple of houses around and lost power because of my brilliant idea. So yeah. I was always getting into trouble for doing crap like that.
Yeah. And when you say you had a lot of energy, it was like mind energy, not so much physical.
Oh, physical energy too. I basically had too much energy. I'm pretty certain that had I been born today here in the U.S., I would probably be on some sort of ADHD drugs. Pretty certain of this. But back then, in Guatemala, there was no such thing. It's just he had a lot of energy. That's all what people said.
And you do exercise daily. Mm-hmm. You exercise on an elliptical machine, hardcore, for 15 minutes every day.
That's my workout.
And how long has that been your regimen, your go-to?
Maybe about 5 or 6 years. And it's really just I'm always trying to break my record, you know, as fast as I can go.
And Tim Ferriss is one of your investors, and he's all about efficiency and work and workouts. Did you have this idea from him, or you were doing this even prior to your relationship?
I was doing this prior to meeting Tim, but he has all kinds of ideas. He's really a pro with this.
What other things do you do that I might not know about? Other quirky parts
things
of Luis?
I don't read books, and which is a rare thing for a professor. The last book I read was in 1998. Mainly it's because I'm very slow at reading.
Do you go back to Guatemala?
I do, about twice a year.
And how does it feel being back?
Well, one of the things is I've become kind of a celebrity there because there's not very many people who are in the tech world from Guatemala. So I've kind of become a bit of a celebrity there. So people recognize me on the street. I mean, not all the people, but it happens almost every time I go out. I go and I basically don't leave my house as I go and I visit my mom.
Because it makes you uncomfortable?
Yeah, that and it's, you know, Guatemala happens to be a dangerous country. And you start being worried about being kidnapped or something like that. And I'm also very happy with the fact that my mom lives in a kind of gated community and barely leaves the house. And also, she's nobody knows what she looks like or anything. So that I'm happy about that.
Are your parents divorced?
No, my dad passed away when I was 13 or 14.
Did that change your relationship with your mother?
Yeah, I mean, I was always very close with my mother. I mean, she's the one who essentially raised me.
And are you an only child?
I am an only child.
Isn't it nice that people appreciate you as a celebrity for doing something of the mind, like for being a computer science geek? That's so nice. You know, it's not like Matt Damon walking down the street.
Right. No, it feels good, and I think, you know, in particular in Guatemala is it's a country with a lot of bad news. I mean, it's just bad stuff happens in Guatemala all the time. So they're very eager to get good news. So when they see somebody, I mean, for example, we have one single Olympic medal of all time. And the guy who won it is a super celebrity because it's like, this is the guy who won the Olympic medal.
Wow.
And so anything that a Guatemalan that is successful,
yeah.
It's people are very eager for that.
An Olympic medal and now a MacArthur Genius Award.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Luis Von Ahn. Coming up, we'll meet Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, a cybersecurity company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, a cybersecurity company. Tanium ensures internet safety for the U.S. government and Fortune 500 companies by spanning across entire networks and identifying intruders within 15 seconds of their entrance. Clients include Amazon, Target, Best Buy, Visa, and the Department of Defense. Orion started Tanium in 2007 with his father, David. Prior, father and son worked together on their other startup, a software company called BigFix that was sold to IBM in 2010 for $400 million. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does Tanium work?
What we realized when we were working on BigFix was that everybody in our space was doing things the same way. Really, that design is called a hub and spoke in our model, but essentially you've got a central server and it's talking to every computer in the environment and it's trying to gather data. And what we realized was, having worked on that for 10 years, that we'd all reached the end of the rope. And the problem is, when you've got an attacker who's coming at you and they can get your data out in 15 minutes, knowing that that happened 3 days later just isn't that valuable. I went to our chief architect at the time and I asked her, what would we need to do to make our system thousands of times faster? And she essentially told me that we'd have to throw everything away and start over. So that's what we did.
Your system is a peer-to-peer system where you have all these computers next to each other talking to each other. And mm-hmm. so there's sort of like this nervous system mm-hmm. that then reports to the central brain or
mm-hmm.
hub.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that further?
We call it a ring topology. It's a very different design. And in our environment, every client is talking to one ahead of them and one behind them. So they really only have two peers that they're talking to. That allows us to control it much more effectively. So you can throttle it. You can make sure that nobody's being hit very aggressively with traffic. It also allows us to secure it really effectively.
You were talking before how the old system was broken, this hub and spoke mm-hmm. system. And I think of your competitors, the incumbents like McAfee and Symantec.
Mm-hmm.
They had these walls that tried to prevent hackers from penetrating. And your model is, let's let these intruders in and then let's tackle them. Can you talk to me about the difference there?
Sure. In a perfect world, we wouldn't let anybody in. The problem is the prevention model that McAfee and Symantec and companies like that have promulgated historically was based on the idea that you could prevent an attack because you'd seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And The problem in our industry today is that attackers have gotten smarter, and as a result of that, the whole prevention model kind of breaks down. What we've been able to do is create a system that gives you real-time views on change so that when an attacker does come in, before they're able to actually do damage, you often can see that they're in and change the environment so that it's impossible for them to cause that damage.
And once they are in and within, you know, 15 seconds you claim you're able to change the environment, what exactly are you doing? How are you changing the environment?
So one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that if you look at the attacks that are succeeding, well over 99% of them are being allowed in because of vulnerabilities everybody knows about. So Microsoft releases these patches every month. A lot of people don't apply them. And so what we've seen is that with our tool, people can actually start doing all the things they knew they were supposed to do, but were really hard with old tools. So just enable all the things, the hygiene that they've known for a long time they were supposed to do. And as a result of that, it makes it a lot harder for attackers to get in. When they do get in, then you want to do things like quarantine computers, send a computer into a different part of the network so that it's not able to talk to your customer database, as an example. And so you can actually control the behavior of the assets that you have that are compromised. Now, the problem has been historically that when you push the button as an IT operator, in old systems, it would take you days before that change actually hit the machine. And the attacker's already gone by then.
Now, you talk about hygiene, and I actually think of the human body. In a way, you are like the antibodies attacking the antigen that comes in, disembodying it. And, you know, hygiene, like we brush our teeth and, you know, you as we as consumers of technology and at enterprise level or consumer level have to do these things that I know I should do and I don't.
Hygiene is actually a really good analogy, and the human body is a really good analogy, because if your brain had to centrally control every cell and tell it what to do, the whole system wouldn't work. So that distributed computing that we do in our body is exactly the same thing that you'll see in our system.
Sometimes people don't even know that their devices are computers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some of the less obvious devices that could be encroached upon? I mean, we know, okay, PCs, ATMs, but what are some others?
Computers are ATMs and heart rate monitors and CAT scanners and point of sale devices and retail shops and cameras and fulfillment centers and all kinds of even door locks that are controlled, you know, using automated systems, really are running Linux and have vulnerabilities, and if they're not patched, they actually are susceptible to attack.
Now, heart rate monitors in hospitals, talk to me about what can go wrong if a hacker touches them.
Oh, I mean, the heart rate monitor can either misreport or stop working. I think there are a lot of people who have a vested interest in causing damage, and especially given our geopolitical situation, I think we really need to consider the possibility that we will be attacked in more and more destructive ways.
Who are these hackers? I think of people maybe like in their bedrooms in Bulgaria or Eastern Europe. Can you give us some profile of the people?
Sure. And I mean, there are some Eastern European hackers who are amazing. I mean, and I think one of the reasons that you associate there is they've had active programs to train people for a long time. So, you know, really, there are three classes of hackers that we see. There's kind of the run-of-the-mill script kid, basically. Somebody who wants to, you know, just basically have fun or get known. You've got the commercial hackers, so they tend to be criminal organizations. They tend to actually be going after customer data or something that they can sell, healthcare data. And then you've got nation-state-level attackers.
You mentioned before that, you know, with your old company, you were approaching cybersecurity in an antiquated way, and then now this company is innovated. How do you know that you're always staying ahead of what sometimes is a failure of imagination? Like, what can people concoct? And
so,
you might not.
No, the answer is we're constantly in a cat-and-mouse game. And so we need to spend enough time really understanding the market and bringing in experts into our company who can educate our engineers on the latest problems so that we can give our customers tools to address them. And it really is a never-ending cycle. I mean, we release a new module every quarter, every 3 months.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, an internet security company that helps protect corporations and governments from cyber attacks. Orion started the company with his father, David, in 2007. You knew this problem existed while you were working at Big Fix, which was your predecessor company that your father founded, and he recruited you to join him, and you left Berkeley and never finished college to your mom's chagrin. But Big Fix was sold to IBM. How come you didn't stay with the company through the sale?
So I actually chose to leave 3 years before the sale. And the reason that I left, I think, is the same reason that they sold the company, which is that we'd reached the maximal point. We could really improve that technology.
So why would IBM want to buy the company then?
There were a lot, and still are, a lot of important customers who use Big Fix. And so, you know, the reality is they're not innovating substantially and haven't since they bought it. You know, as a technologist, it's really disappointing. From a business standpoint, I think they feel like they made a good decision.
So you and your dad left in frustration. And for, you know, basically 5 years, you kind of worked underground even before you had your first client. Can you talk to me about those days?
David and I actually had some choices to make when we left Big Fix because we sold a lot of our stock as we left. And as a result of that, you know, we lived pretty simple lives. We didn't actually have to go back to work at all. And we both decided that we were going to take a little bit of time off. And I think both within literally weeks of leaving realized that we were super bored. You know, what we realized was we knew things that would allow us to build a system that was just better.
What did those days look like when you were working on this? It was informal.
We had a couple luxuries. So the first one was we knew we didn't have to get a product out the door and we hadn't taken any money from venture capitalists. So there was no drumbeat that was applied to us. And we also only hired people we'd already worked with. And we gave them the latitude to actually take the time necessary to build something that was built right from the ground up. And, you know, I'll make an analogy. If you look at a lot of products in our space, they look like, you know, it was originally a two-bedroom house, and then they kept on adding bedrooms until the point it's a seven-bedroom house, but the foundation is too small. And we knew that if we built it right from scratch, we'd be able to actually build something that would sustain the test of time. Hmm. And so we gave them 5 years, but more importantly, we actually worked with some of our old customers from Big Fix to beta test our product in their environment during that time. When we actually, in 2012, went to market, we'd already deployed it on hundreds of thousands of computers.
For free.
Absolutely. And worked with those companies to figure out how we could make it work better. Again, I really appreciate the venture capitalists that we've brought in recently because I think they can really help us at this stage of the company. But the luxury of taking the time necessary to really build something we're proud of as craftsmen rather than as, you know, kind of a rush job, I think is what made Tanium.
And you had a pivot moment in 2014 where you did bring in your first institutional or venture capital. Mm-hmm. You raised money primarily from Andreessen Horowitz. Mm-hmm. What was the catalyst for taking on a significant amount of capital so quickly?
You know, really there were two things that we saw. The first was that I'm looking at a market that is not going to continue the way that it is. And the reason that I say that is there are too many companies raising money at too high valuations that really are not producing anything that I can see. And I think that's going to change. I don't think that there's going to be an opportunity to raise money like we have, not just us, but everybody in our industry over the last couple of years. And we now have $300 million in the bank, and that gives me the cushion that I need regardless of what happens to the macroeconomic climate, regardless of what happens to this release or that release, to ensure that I can actually do a great job for my customers. So that's one. The second reason was Andreessen Horowitz has a capability that I've never seen before, which is they have something called the Executive Briefing Center, where they bring in 1,800 customers a year. And they tend to be global 2000 companies that are really great targets for Tanium. And they bring them in to show them what's new in Silicon Valley and really what they should be paying attention to. And if you look at the customers who've bought Tanium, more than 50% of them actually were touched in that executive briefing center.
And this was even before you took capital from them. They made introductions for you.
That's right.
Speaking of Andreessen Horowitz, I want to talk about your maybe it was your first meeting with them where you showed them the software and it was so fast that they assumed it was like a mock-up. And they asked, well, how long will it take to build for real? And you said, well, actually, it is live. What was that story?
One of the problems in our industry is that people will show you a mock-up and pretend it's real. And often it's physically impossible to build what they're showing, and they just want to kind of bait people into believing it's real long enough that they can go and figure out something else to do. Tanium, we went to them and showed them a production hospital, and we just walked them through the problems that this hospital had and how they were solving it using Tanium. And so, yes, they didn't believe it. And it was actually funny because I got all the way through the demo before they asked me how long it was going to take to build it. And when I told them it was all real, they actually asked me to walk through a lot of it again because, you know, like now that we actually know it's possible, we really want to see that in nuanced form.
You showed them a hospital in California. Mm-hmm. What are examples of issues that that hospital was facing?
Data leakage is one of the things that a lot of people worry about. For example, people using Dropbox or people using LogMeIn. You know, these are products that people think they should be able to use because they make their jobs easier. Maybe they can send something to Dropbox so that they can then use it from home or whatever it is. And if you're a hospital, that's a huge HIPAA violation, mm-hmm. right? And so computers aren't built in some ways to allow you to manage this very effectively. And yet, as a hospital, if somebody leaks patient data, you have to disclose it. It can be a very expensive proposition. And so the first thing we showed them was, here's every way to get data out of this hospital, and here's what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Here are all the people who are actually using Dropbox or LogMeIn or Box. Here are all the people who are sending data out and what data they're sending.
Steven Sinofsky was one of the partners in that meeting. He was at Microsoft, and mm-hmm. he led Microsoft Windows, and he's on your board now. Was that one of the stipulations of your relationship, that you would take their money and that you wanted Steven on your board?
It's a very interesting question. So a lot of people in our position would have asked for the biggest name, and so Mark or Ben or somebody that, and what we realized was Steven actually had extremely deep domain expertise in things we didn't already know. So he really understands the operating system landscape and the partnership landscape. And so we did request that we get Steven.
Titanium is an element. What is Tanium?
What actually ended up happening was I went to a website to go and look up domain names that were available and went through literally 420 pages of domain names before I found one that I wanted and bought it.
And is it a real word?
Nope. I mean, it's basically a play on the word titanium. You know, I'll tell you this, the overthinking of names is really funny to me because, I mean, we sold a company called Big Fix for $400 million and it doesn't get any worse than that, so.
You have been in business with your father basically since you left college. Did you always have a sense that, yeah, my dad and I are going to work together? Or was it more accidental than that?
So I've had a close relationship with my father my whole life. I'm very, very close to him. I always have been. And I didn't know, even when I started college, that I wanted to go and work with my dad. What I saw, though, was that Big Fix was this nascent company, and it was really struggling to find a mission. And there was a need for a big shakeup. And I realized, A, I knew a lot about this problem, but B, that I was getting really bored at school. Mm-hmm. And so it was fortuitous, actually. Working with my dad has been probably one of the biggest luxuries in my life.
What is he like?
He is the most honest, disciplined person I know.
Where's your mom in all this?
My mom is furious that I didn't graduate from college and brings that up every day.
Do you think that just to please her, I mean, you only have like physical education left and like one economics class. Why don't you just do it to please her and then move on?
Well, that is a consideration.
A birthday present.
Yes. You know, when Tanium's done in 20 years and we've wrapped that up, maybe I'll go back and get the degree.
Your father is from Iraq. How old was he when he moved to Israel?
So he was 4 years old. He actually had to move before his parents did because of the way that they had an exodus from Iraq. And so he spent almost a year basically in a relocation camp in Israel.
With his siblings or by himself?
Nope, by himself.
Is this in 48?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of my dad was formed in the process of leaving Iraq, getting to Israel. And really, you know, his family had been well off in Iraq and they started from nothing at that point.
What do you remember about growing up that you think your parents, you know, that they let you do that, you know, others might not let you do? Or is there anything kind of unconventional about the way they raised you?
So the most interesting pictures of me growing up are me sitting at a computer when I'm way too young to sit at a computer. And so when I was two, I had an Apple Lisa sitting in our house that I was allowed to play with, and very few people were allowed to play with those, even adults, because they were really expensive.
Now, an Apple Lisa is one of the first Apple computers, Lisa being, I think, Steve Jobs' daughter's
That's
name.
Right.
What might I not know about you?
What might you not know about me? I love playing video games. So for somebody who is entrusted by 50 of the Fortune 100 to manage their security, the fact that I buy almost every good video game and finish it is something you probably wouldn't know and they probably wouldn't assume.
Now, there's a big change in video games from when you were a kid to now. I mean, whether it's like Super Mario Brothers or Ms. Pac-Man, which is now, which is like a whole other 3D virtual worlds. Which do you prefer?
So I never have nostalgia for the old games. I never play games over more than once. So, I mean, what used to be movies are now video games, you know, and it's interactive and immersive. I mean, human interaction and the way that we're going to entertain ourselves is just completely going to change. And it's beautiful.
Great. I totally disagree with you, but that's fine.
Imagine that you could go to every museum in the world. Every museum, you could just push a button and you could be in Paris.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Could be worse.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Orion Hindawi. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.